My name's Daniel Ashman. I've been doing a series of Life is Sacred vigils, which are 28-hour vigils outside complicit organisations in the genocide of Gaza in the UK, in London mainly at the moment. So far, I've done a vigil outside Downing Street, Ministry of Defence, Home Office, Foreign Office, Met Police, Ministry of Justice, and my latest one has been the Financial Conduct Authority. And it's been quite a journey. It's quite fascinating. So the great thing about these vigils is that I'm there in the morning when people come into work. I'm there when they come out for their lunch. I'm also there when they finish work, and then I'm there in the morning with my signs the next day as well. And the response in general, in Downing Street, it was a bit different because you don't get that level of workforce or going into that space. But in all the other buildings, there are hundreds of people coming in and out, and there is a very real sense amongst quite a few of them that they feel complicit, or they feel trapped, or they feel a sense of moral outrage about what is happening and what the government is doing right now.
Well, that's nice to know, but I mean, the last one you've done, the Financial Conduct Authority, I mean, they are an interesting organisation because, as far as I know, they are actually now entirely funded by the City of London, the big commercial banks and financial institutions. So, this isn't really the way to run regulation.
Well, they've got like four different or five different subjects which they also regulate on, and none of them really deal with harm to other human beings outside of their organization. So it's quite inward looking, their regulation. So it looks at reputational damage to the shareholders, for example, and sustainability of purchases of assets or shares. And so it's more of a regulatory force to protect buyers of shares, as it were, than it is a moral arbiter
Well, no,
of
well, I mean, this is a real problem because if you can imagine an economy which isn't going very well, like the British economy, what quite often happens is the less moral companies start getting engaged in wars, arms firms, and things like that. And so, you know, billions of pounds of investors' money flows into these arms firms. And I suppose the Financial Conduct Authority wouldn't bat an eyelid.
Well, so far, with regards to Gaza, they haven't. I have requested information from them. I filled in a whistleblowing application, which you can go onto their website and you can find the contact details and you can lobby yourself. But yeah, to my knowledge, they haven't. They did with Russia, however. And for them to trigger their investigations, where they can request documents, they can freeze highly kind of risky or likely the offending shares or transactions. They have to be triggered by the Foreign Office, the Ministry of Defence, and the Treasury in order for them to act upon those. On that subject area. Technically, you could probably find a way through their regulations, in which I've also drafted a kind of a bespoke template, which I've passed to a few people to try it out to see if they will if it will have any success in talking in their language in terms of their regulatory powers. But the reality is we can all see what's happening. They can see what's happening. Everybody can see what's happening. And there is absolutely no real reason other than complicity, essentially, why these things have not been enacted now. It's a contributor towards the killing of the families of Palestine. Absolutely.
Well, the government certainly seems to be interested in trying to get the economy going. One of the companies they're working with is this big American, American-based private equity firm called BlackRock, who, for anyone that hasn't had a good look, there is a link on my website every week, actually, to a video called Who Runs the World, which came out during COVID, which is by a Dutch lady who name escapes me. But anyway, it's a super little video. And what it does is it shows you how the hedge funds like BlackRock, their business model is to go into not into investing in a business, but go into invest in a market. So, in other words, they will be investing in maybe, you know, anything up to 10, 12 different companies that do similar things and that are competing with each other. And then they go along to the boards and they say to the boards, if you do this and do this, we will continue to invest in you. And if you don't, we will use our shareholding to remove the directors that are existing directors of this business. So that's their tactic. Yeah. It's about controlling markets. And of course, that's a very good way to make money. If you can control a market, you can also start price fixing. You can control how much people have to pay for a basic good or services, whether that be cars all the way down to water or whatever. Anyway, they're a very interesting company, BlackRock. I'd like to see the entire London press investigating every single breath they take. You can quote the police, you know, but they don't really. They almost totally ignore it. And that one of the reasons for that is because BlackRock obviously invested shares in quite a lot of these big London media firms themselves. So anyway, you've been digging around, Dan, haven't you?
Yeah. So there's one Israeli company called Bet Shemesh. And their shares surged 560% since October 2023. And BlackRock have got 0.86% of those shares, and that's around $13 million. So it's not small money. And then there's Elbit Systems as well, which there's a £2 billion British contract being tabled at the moment by Keir Starmer and by the I think I can't remember the name of the department. I'm so many. It used to be the Business Innovation and Skills Department. They sign off on weapon licenses. I think it's slightly changed now. The department, but there'll be a department that signs off on these licenses as well, and they have to go through a routine check to make sure that these things, these items, aren't being used in war crimes. And of course, we've got the Desi Arms Fair coming up in September, and they're going to have lots of human rights abusive regimes coming to the Arms Fair to network and to buy all of these items. And BlackRock will have shares in quite a lot of them. So here's a list of some of the shares which they've got, companies they've got shares in: Lockheed Martin, and they do the F-35 jets; Caterpillar used as bulldozers and destructive equipment in the demolishing of Palestinian settlements and building of illegal settlements. There's Amazon, Alphabet, which is Google, Microsoft, IBM, Palantir, Barclays, and Barclays have got their own shares as well. BNP Paribas, Alliance, PIMCO, Vanguard. So there's a lot, it can seem overwhelming. Because there aren't as many people as you think behind this as the numbers would suggest. You know, there's not that many of them, actually. And so it's really important to realize it's largely the power of money, which is the conditioned value system that we abide by, that at some point we have to transcend if we're going to break the cycles of violence.
Well, look, this is a massive problem, Dan. What you've got is you've got different, as you hinted there, different systems of value, haven't you? So you've got the value of human life is one thing. You've got the value of money is another. And sometimes it might be that, you know, you can make a lot of money, but a lot of people are going to die. So it seems to me that we've got these kind of two competing moral systems. As many of the religious figures over the years have pointed out, you know, money being the root of all evil, or the love of money being the root of all evil. And so, I mean, it seems to me right now, I don't know what you think, but the whole value system around money has kind of almost taken over from our previous moral values. Like Winston Churchill, at the beginning of the Second World War, said that Hitler is launching this attack on Christian civilization. Well, hang on a minute, because maybe he's won.
Well, in all honesty, what Hitler lived out was a fetish of the kind of pan-European elite, kind of, you know, international class of that time. They all fetishized their superiority, and they all told stories about how these people were inhuman and didn't deserve life, or didn't, you know, needed to be civilized, which actually a lot of that language is happening in Israel, and the supporters of the continued ethnic cleansing campaign, which is going on. And it's the same old trick, you know, like whether people tell themselves God says we're his chosen people, and that gives us the right to commit violence. I mean, royalty across the board uses that excuse. Jihadists use that excuse, and So does Israel, the Israeli government now.
I mean, to be fair, there's loads and loads of atheists out there who all to agree that, you know, that actually life is far more valuable than money. And so, but it seems like that doesn't count with BlackRock. Listen, you've been investigating. I know you've been looking into BlackRock and their links to the British government, but at the end of 2024, just around the time of the Rachel Reeves budget, I think it was around October or so, we had this visit, famous visit, lots of cameras in there, of Larry Fink from BlackRock to Downing Street itself with some of his top executive people. It was almost as if, well, we've got this new government in Britain. BlackRock is coming in to negotiate immediately what's going to be happening with Britain's assets, and you kind of reminded a little bit of the rape of Russia in the 1990s, where the oligarchs came in under the Yeltsin government in Russia, and they basically just cleaned up. So it obviously, these wealthy people, they would really rather like to come in and grab Britain's assets. So what's been going on more recently with BlackRock?
So they met recently behind closed doors, and won't disclose what's being talked about because of commercial sensitivity. And Larry Fink has been made the head of the World Economics Forum as well. So, and when I was talking actually to someone who was quite high up in the FCA. She came down to talk to me. This is why there was quite... My most recent vigil, it was quite surprising how open, actually, the people were to communicating with me, because I didn't expect that at all, but they were. And so this lady called Emily was talking to me about it. And I did ask, you know, like, I put some of these questions to her, which you said that, you know, if you're essentially a private company that is paid for by the financiers or the companies, Does that not restrict you in terms of what you can do and who you can go after? They obviously have their point of view, which isn't that, you know. I talked about BlackRock Tour, and I said, look, you know, I understand they're big fish, but ultimately, these men, mainly men, and some women too, are profiting off the killing of families, Palestinian families. It's incontrovertible. You can see it in the numbers. They're spreading their bets and making money. They're enabling genocide. And there is, with the Geneva Convention, famously after the Second World War, there were complicit companies and people who ran those companies who were held to account. Not all of them, mind you, but there was, I suppose, a token nod to that conduct there, because it's the wealthy, it's the tax haven class or members of that cultural group that don't face any of the consequences and only reap the monetary gain from that conflict, from the genocide in Gaza and other conflicts, of course, around the world. And this seems to me like one of the gravest injustices, because there is no incentive for peace. Peace is bad for business for these guys. But somehow, why is their enrichment more important than a child's life? You know, that's the problem. We've got a system or a cultural value system with money that places someone who's already got more than they can ever spend, more than they ever need, their accumulatory power, above the sacred life of a child.
Did you say Alison was her name?
Emily.
Emily, yeah. Sorry. What was Emily's reaction to your questioning then?
She took it on board. She said she was going to go and find out some information for me. And she was going to try and respond to my query. My fear was after that, because I think a little bit of traction had. I think they would have got more letters through, or more queries through, trying to stimulate the regulatory process after it. I think they might close up. But I had some interesting reactions from people who were working in the building, a lot of support. But there was also a fellow who was working in the building who was very angry at me. He was pro-Palestine. He was very angry at me that I was sitting there with a sign aiding and abetting genocide as a crime, because the implication was that they were aiding and abetting genocide. He says, but this isn't our remit. This hasn't got nothing to do with us, you know, he was saying. He was saying that and the people in that building are the most ethical, kind-hearted people that he's ever worked with. So you've got it all completely wrong. And I've looked at what they have, how they have regulated and who they have gone after before. And they have actually gone after some of these big fish, you know, but it's a fine, you know, a couple of million here and a couple of million there. But these are multi-billion trillion. They'll probably make that on interest on their, of just holding money in a bank. They make money out of just having money.
Yeah. Anyway, so Larry Fink, the boss of BlackRock, was in to see Keir Starmer. But at the end of May, we know, because someone managed to snap a picture of him coming out of Downing Street. But we know apparently nothing about that meeting at all.
Yeah. So I picked this up from off a post of someone's X account, and they posted some quotes. So I'm just kind of getting that up now. Here we go. So he's highlighted, I can confirm a meeting took place on the 20th of May. the office holds some recorded information in relation to this engagement, this is exempt from disclosure under Section 35 and 43 of the commercial of the Act. So they're using laws themselves in order to say, look, we don't have to tell you what's going on. And then on the second page, it says some of the information is also exempt under Section 35(1)(d), which protects the operations of any ministerial private office with the aim of preserving a safe space for the private office to focus on managing the minister's work efficiently without external interference and distraction. So we've got one law which says public malfeasance, public office malfeasance is a crime. And then on the other, you've got another law that says, actually, we're not allowed to know what they're getting up to because of it might affect their workflow and their capacity to do their work. So you kind of go, well, how is completely inconsistent? How can we even tell if malfeasance, public malfeasance of office is happening if you're not allowed to know what these public representatives are even discussing?
It's interesting they won't tell you anything, because the City AM have managed to get some information about that meeting. BlackRock apparently BlackRock raised concerns over regulatory delays for businesses. And so he's saying, obviously, he wanted some changes to the regulations for businesses, which hadn't been happening fast enough. He told the government to make it simpler for global companies to compete in the UK. So, in other words, to buy up UK assets. And that was the FT that reported that, as well as City AM. So, I mean, you know, it's good that you get some papers where we'll see, oh, this is actually quite a significant little leak here of some kind. So it sounds to me like, you know, the publicly available information about what's being discussed, the Freedom of Information people don't want to tell anybody anything. Starmer reportedly, it's not about freedom of information, clearly, it's about something else. Apparently, he told executives of his plan to overhaul British regulators, that's Starmer, allowing a streamlined regulatory approval process. So that the idea is that the regulations get changed wherever, in whichever way that BlackRock want quickly. Last month, that's back in April, say City AM, Larry Fink declared that the UK is undervalued and he wanted to change the regulations, which would help with the Chancellor's growth agenda. So I guess he just wants to be buying up assets more and more here, which obviously include things like our public services.
Yeah, so on one hand, like, you know, like the forecasting of the economy, they do it quarterly and they go, oh, this quarter is, we're up 0.05%. This is doing great, blah, 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 like it's a football match, right? And then, but they never say what it is that's actually encouraged the economy. The assumption is if something goes up in terms of monetary value, then everyone's better off. But of course, if it's only going up in a very, very small sector of the, like, if you only water a bit of a field, then that bit will grow, the rest will die. You know what I mean? It's that kind of mentality. They're just looking for the headlines.
Well, that's right. And also, if say, for example, it's just in property, that means rent's going up. But wages aren't going up in line with it. So this is bad for everybody. Yeah, so that's growth, but it's bad for everybody.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean,
the landlords
are in exponential growth. The tax haven class are in exponential growth. They're in exponential growth through COVID. They're in exponential growth through genocide. They're the casino. The casino always wins, you know? This is why I do feel like there needs to be a redrawing of some of the linguistics within the way we define things, because it can be a bit too inward looking and it doesn't see the relationship between the tax haven class and the national economies around the world, you know?
Yeah, well, Margaret Thatcher did this thing, the Big Bang, in the early 1980s, which was the deregulation of the city. Up until that point, it had been pretty strictly regulated. And it seems as if the idea really is that if you can make money at it, it doesn't matter what you do, just do it.
Yeah.
And that's what they, when you're deregulating, that's effectively what happens, is you get this kind of form of anarcho-capitalism, where the rules get torn up everywhere they're standing in the way of any investment. And that's effectively, I think, where we're heading with particularly with this government, Dan. Anyway, I know you, I'm not going to ask you to disclose where your next Life is Sacred Vigil is taking place, because it's like a surprise attack, although I probably shouldn't use the word attack. But anyway, if people are interested in following what you're up to, how do they find and follow you? What's the best way?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. It's Daniel_Ashman on X, sorry. And then on Facebook, Dan Ashman. But also, I am in the process of doing a website. I'm in the process of doing that side of things. I'm hoping, to be honest with you, to accumulate a few more interested parties to want to take on some of that stuff, because of obviously with the research, with everything and all of the social media platforms, it gets all a bit a lot, you know. There's only so many interactions you can do in a day, you know what I mean?
Well, tell me about it. Yeah, I think we're all in a similar boat, actually.
Yeah, yes. Well, exactly. But I mean, what I do like, what is happening, is that there is a conversation happening, and there is knowledge being shared, and there are ideas being tested out and tried. And to be honest with you, it's got to be full spectrum. Every nook and cranny, every chance at communication and communicating and understanding the languages that exist within these various institutions, and we've got the tools at our disposal, really, to be able to unlock them and unpick them, and to understand them. And there's an awareness happening and an awakening happening to how things are operating and why they're not happening the way they should. So Larry Fink, for example, should be in jail. He should be in jail because there's a profiteer and he's been aiding and abetting genocide. And now he's the leader of the World Economic Forum. These guys are... they have no shame. So long as they don't admit anything in public, you know, they feel quite safe, you know.
Also, the British government is giving the guy a bit of cover, isn't it, by saying we can't tell you anything, even though it's been published in the Financial Times. Look, finally, Dan, people do come to London quite a lot. We've had hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. Do you think it'll make any difference? Yeah.
Oh, it has made a difference. You know, when even on the ground in Gaza, it's absolutely. Am I allowed to swear? It's atrocious. It's beyond words. What is taking place? Just think what would happen if no one was looking. Just think what would be happening if there wasn't actually the outcry. It's bad now, but just think what it would be if there wasn't the response. There would be absolutely no restraint. You know, the ICC, as much as it may be a fig leaf for capitalist imperialists, it has tried to do the right thing, you know. And so there is some things which are trying to do the right thing for the families of Gaza, and of course we've failed so far. And stopping this and ceasefire happening will only be luxury for those that are living, and they've got to deal with all their grief, and they've got to reunite with their families and find a way forward. You know, there's so much to come beyond the violence. So this is why ceasefire is so important. And I know there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of rationalizing, regardless of where people stand. But really, it's about ceasefire for me right now, because that's the life-giving action, is the withdrawal of violence. That's going to be
life-giving. The worry is, though, of course, as soon as the ceasefire happens, so the big red lines on the graphs in the City of London start going down again.
Well, this is what needs to be addressed culturally as a people. Without them, they don't have to be involved in this discussion, because actually we need to decide as a people what we stand for, what we will stand for, and what we want to express in, and how we want to live. How do we want to trade? How do we want to do all of those things? And that's been in constant flowering throughout intergenerational history. You know, there's always been that drive, that consciousness, that the pain of it and the trauma of it, but also the endeavor and the collaboration to try and change things and to try and make them better for you know, the community, for the children, next generation, you know. So it's at play. It is happening. The 20th century was a violent, violent time, as well as a time of technological prowess, you know. But now we've kind of got, I think the challenge is to find a common consensus and an agreement that this is the way forward. You know, and it doesn't involve sticking poor people in cages, you know what I mean, because they don't have the right passport. Or it doesn't involve, it's about us communicating how we can do it together, what we need to do, and all of those things. And there is no easy, like, quick fix. Although, joining some of the genocide enablers is actually paramount, because they're in a position of harm, they're in gatekeeping positions, and they need to be stopped. They just need to be stopped.
Okay, Dan Ashman, thanks ever so much for joining us again. And please do keep us posted on your Sanctity of Life vigils. What's it called again? It's not that, is it?
Yeah, okay. Life is Sacred vigils.
Life is Sacred, that'll do. All right, thanks very much, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Tony.